Friends, when was the last time your church had a Missions Sunday? And how did it go? Did people take steps of obedience to the Great Commission? Or did the message go in one ear and out the other? Well, here at ABWE, our team has created a new resource that's everything that you need in one free resource packet to pull off an effective and biblically grounded Missions Sunday. We're calling it Send Sunday based on Acts 13, where the first missionaries are sent out from a local church. This isn't just getting people to think about missions. It's challenging each church to ask the question, Lord, whom would you send out from our midst? And how can we hold the rope for them? Download everything that you need for Send Sunday, including sermon resources, a sample order of worship, lesson plans, small group discussion guides, a prayer guide, and more. Everything that you'll need to make sure that Send Sunday effectively challenges your congregation with what the Word of God says about missions. Go to missionspodcast.com/sendsunday and get access now to this free toolkit. Again, missionspodcast.com/sendsunday. And we'll celebrate Send Sunday with you on June 8th, 2025. Greetings and welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I'm Alex Kochman, Director of Communications and Engagement for ABWE, joined once again by my partner in crime, Scott Dunford, pastor of Western Hills Church in San Mateo, California. And we're so pleased to have you with us for another journey into the exciting world of missiology and engaging the culture around us with the gospel. We've got a returning guest today, but before we introduce him, I want to let you know that if you've not yet had a chance to take a look into our premium content portal, we've got lots of interesting offerings for you there, including today's bonus episode. In the overtime segment, we'll be discussing what is the mood, the temperature in the American church right now in light of all the cultural changes towards missions. Is it a missions favorable mood in the American church? Is it not so favorable towards missions? And how do we think about that issue in light of the conversation we're about to have with our current guest, who's returning to the show? And we'll give you just a moment to introduce yourself, Aaron. But before we do that as well, too, also want to mention that if you've not yet left this show a positive rating and review in your podcast platform of choice, that does help us to bring this content to more people, get it exposed to those that can be blessed by it and mobilized by it. And so remember to do that, especially if you're an Apple Podcasts user. We know that you're out there. With all that housekeeping out of the way, Scott, I'm excited to have Aaron back on the show. Aaron, Wren joins us. He's the author of The Three Worlds, and he's also written many things, including an article a few years ago in First Things by that same name. Aaron, can you bring our listeners back up to speed with your work, your writings on your Substack, your podcast? And you've had a career that's been a mixture of various things from evangelical cultural commentary to urban trends and everything in between. So please bring us back up to speed.
Sure. Well, I guess the most notable thing is almost exactly a year ago, my book-length treatment of my Three Worlds model, which is called Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture, was released. It's on Zondervan Reflective. So that was my first book with a major publisher. So I was very excited about that.
Congratulations.
And continue to write and podcast at my newsletter, www.aaronwren.com. You should definitely sign up for that. And I write for other publications as well. I still do some urbanism work, but a lot of my work is focused on cultural diagnostics related to the church and also men and masculinity. It just continues to grow and I continue to stay busy.
Also, I was hanging out not that long ago with our mutual friend, Josh Abitoy, and you're involved also in founding something called American Reformer, which if our listeners aren't familiar with that, tell us a little bit about American Reformer.
Sure. American Reformer is you could call it a think tank. We don't typically use that term, but it is a Protestant think tank that does a few things. One, we have a journal, the American Reformer Journal. You can find that at AmericanReformer.org, which has a lot of great intellectual analysis from a whole lot of people. We also run a fellows program for sort of emerging leaders, the Cotton Mather Fellow, which is pretty good. And we have a reform effort that partners with stakeholders and institutions to help them navigate the challenges of today's world, or to correct mission drift in some cases. And then we have some centers affiliated with American Reformer, such as the Center for Academic Faithfulness and Flourishing, which is more of a scholarly type think tank, traditional think tank center focused on Christian higher education. We actually just put out there what is, without a doubt, the best and most in-depth Christian college guide that I have ever seen. It's that may be Christian College Guide.com. I wish I was prepared for that question, because now I don't remember the name of it. But if you Google it, it is truly impressive. It's got everything a family could ever want to know about a college. You know, their the majors they have, to their policies around dorm visitations, to their student life, to statements of faith. It's really a tool to empower parents. And we don't do ratings or rankings. We just give you the data and the tools so you can decide what's important to you. And so definitely check that out.
Excellent. Well,
that's all interesting stuff. So refresh our memory. It's been a while since you were on the show last. Can you just kind of refresh us on what the negative world or the three world model is?
So America never had a state church, but for most of our history, we had a sort of softly institutionalized generic Protestantism as our default national religion. So as recently as the 1950s, half of all adults attended church every Sunday. We had prayer and Bible reading in our public schools. We were adding "In God We Trust" to our money, "Under God to the Pledge." That's the kind of country it was. Starting in the 1960s, this began to become unraveled, and the status of Christianity went into decline in America, a decline that persists to the present day. And I divide that period of decline from roughly 1964 to the present into three eras or worlds that I call the positive world, the neutral world, and the negative world. The positive world is 1964 to 1994. And I want to be clear about one thing. This is an era of decline. All is not going well for the church. And yet Christianity is still basically seen positively. To be known as a good church-going man makes you seem like an upstanding member of society. And Christian morality is still the basic moral norms of society. And if you violate them, you can get into trouble. In 1994, we hit a tipping point into what I call the neutral world, where Christianity is not seen positively anymore, but it's not really seen negatively yet either. It's just one more lifestyle choice among many in a sort of pluralistic public square. Christian morality has a sort of residual effect. Then in 2014, we enter the negative world, where for the first time in the 400-year history of America, official elite culture now views Christianity negatively, or certainly at least skeptically. Maybe that's a better way to look at it. To be known as a Bible-believing Christian does not help you get a job in the elite domains of society. And Christian sort of morality, traditional Christian morality, is expressly repudiated, and in many ways is seen as a new threat to the new public morality. And so this has really been dislocating to American Christians, to say the least, who have been used to thinking themselves as representing the cultural mainstream of America, or perhaps you might say the moral majority, as the name of that famous article put it. And so that is the model in a nutshell.
So what's been some of the reception since you released Life in the Negative World, which, of course, I vastly butchered the name of the book when I introduced you earlier. But what has been some of the positive reception or pushback you've received since releasing that full book length treatment of the model?
Sure. I originally wrote it as a newsletter issue in 2017, and it went viral then. Then I updated it for the 2022 First Things magazine, and it went viral then. And then, of course, I wrote the book. What I would say is I got some pushback from the First Things piece, mostly overwhelmingly positive. It's basically the most discussed article in the history of First Things magazine.
Wow, really?
And I mean, it's just like this is like something people just keep talking about it. And a lot of people are still discovering it for the first time. Mm-hmm. But some people kind of disagreed with it. The book actually got a very positive reception. Even the people that we would say were quote unquote critical were actually still pretty positive. Some of it is I actually did tighten up some of the argumentation in response to some of the article. One, the advantage of writing the article first is that you get to see what people say or where they're unclear on something, and you can clarify for the next iteration. So that went well. So the book got great reviews and I would say an all round positive response. I don't think there were any like truly like negative hit job reviews, even from people who weren't totally positive about it. So that was very good. And what I'd say is, in the book, I talk about, in the article, I talk about the three worlds, but I also talk about the three different groups of evangelicals in America. The culture war, religious right group, the seeker sensitive group, or maybe the mainstream megachurch, non-denom megachurch, kind of suburban Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then a group I call cultural engagers, who are sort of the urban church movement, college town movement, really who emerged in the 90s. And what I'd say is those three groups responded in different ways. The culture war people basically didn't respond. I think very few people who are like major figures in the culture war movement really had anything to do with it. A couple of them kind of maybe have rediscovered it a bit recently, but it basically didn't get much waves there. The people who love it the most are those mainstream megachurch pastors. They absolutely love it. And that is where the most enthusiastic response has come by far. I just got a text from a pastor of a large multi-site megachurch. A guy I didn't know just texted me out of the blue, "Hey, just wanted to let you know, I'm reading your book. It's great. My elders are reading it. Just want to encourage you." I'm like, wow, that's like amazing to see. The group that liked it the least, I would say, not always hostile, but I think have been less enthusiastic, you might say, are the cultural engagers. And by nature, as someone who's sort of been, an urban guy, in fact, you know, worked for a think tank studying urban policy, lived in Chicago and New York most of my adult life. It's interesting that it's kind of my own people who liked it the least. We could go into the various reasons why, but I think their basic view has been that they've got a pretty good handle on things. Thank you very much. And we got it right. So nothing needs to change here. That's probably an oversimplification. But that's kind of the different responses, I would say, that I've gotten.
Why do you think you got the response you did? I mean, especially with the megachurch pastors, why do you think that they responded so positively about it? Did it just give them kind of a category in which to fit what they were already thinking, or did it push them in some unique way?
That's right. I don't think it's like that. I took something that they were already seeing. Mm-hmm. And I gave them a language to talk about it and a framework to make sense out of it. And I think that's why they liked it so much. It's not like this is totally alien stuff that they're getting. It's like, oh yeah, this is my life. This is how the world has changed over the course of my ministry. This is how the cultural waves that started maybe in those big cities is now washing over the shores of, you know, suburban middle America. And very much that. It's interesting. This is actually the group I kind of knew the least about personally. I grew up in a rural culture war church, you know, Assemblies of God during the kind of heyday of, the religious right, Pat Robertson, like the 1980s and the end times and all that stuff. And then as an adult, primarily in sort of urban church, environments, very culture engager. And so I never really spent a lot of time like attending like a traditional, what you think of as a traditional evangelical megachurch. Didn't really know that world. And I probably had a lot of things we don't know personally have some misconceptions about it. And I think one of them was that I'd see the clip of the skinny jeans pastor go viral on social media. I'd think to myself, that guy's an extremely charismatic speaker, but these guys are kind of lightweights, probably. And, you know, what I've discovered is, although their style is kind of very different from what I'm used to, a lot of these guys are actually very deep. And they're very strategically and operationally savvy. And they're thinking about these issues. Mm. And I mean, they're thinking about missional effectiveness. And, you know, so they're actually like a lot deeper, I think, than maybe I or other people gave them credit for. Not just because they like my book, although it's always good that they have, it's always nice that they have good taste in literature. But, yes. You know, just I was just been listening to this podcast by a couple of these guys, and they're like having an extended segment on like, here is thoughts about who should be on your church board. You know, what kinds of people should be on there? What kinds of people shouldn't? How do people bring different perspectives? Here's what happens if you have too many lawyers. Here's what, or accountants or doctors. Here's what happens with this. And again, you could say I agree with some of it, maybe don't agree with some of it. But the point is, like, they've thought in granular detail about stuff like that, which is exactly what, like, I come from a management consulting background. Like, that's the sort of thing, like, top consultants would be thinking about. So there are very much people, I think, who are always taking in and are attuned to the market and trying to understand, you know, where it's going and where it's at. And so it's been interesting to kind of come into contact with some of these people.
And yeah, well, and not to get too ahead of ourselves, because I do want to wait until be a little bit later in the conversation to think about, okay, what are the strategies or tactics that we should employ in the negative world or the not so negative world? But I think a lot of the relevance for that group of readers, those that are in that kind of attractional mega church world, is that a lot of the methodologies that they inherited were neutral world methods, and they're increasingly less popular in a setting where people are less likely to dip their toe casually into the water of Christianity. And I think that model's become gradually a little bit less effective over time. But one thing that I've noticed in the current sort of cultural shift, vibe shift, if you will, that's happening is that a growing number of evangelical Christians are talking about the importance of getting their own house in order and of organizing their own families and households in the ways of the Lord. And in light of that, we wanted to remind you that this episode comes to you through our sponsorship and partnership relationship with Reformation Heritage Books that has a variety of trusted Christian and Reformed resources available to you as well to help you ground yourself in the faith, including the new Family Worship Bible that they offer, which includes prompts and questions to guide family discussions through each chapter of Scripture. So if you've ever struggled to lead in family worship or family devotions, this gives you a step-by-step guide through each chapter of Scripture to facilitate with your family. And you can learn more by visiting heritagebooks.org/family-worship or check out our show notes for additional details. And they'd also like to let you know that as a thank you for their ministry partnership with us, that if you are on their website and use the promotional code MissionsPod, all one word, all caps, MissionsPod, you'll receive 10% off anything that you order from our friends at Reformation Heritage Books. And so thank you to RHB for sponsoring today's conversation. Aaron, to kind of move things along just a little bit, you mentioned recently on your Substack that you were toying with the question of whether or not the negative world is ending. And you cited a few recent examples, even from one Joe Rogan episode, about some of the vibe shift that's happening now in the culture. What made you prompt that question? What prompted that question in your mind, and how do you answer it?
Well, this isn't the first time that I've written on that topic. I've actually written about it a number of times. But every time some event happens, like this Wesley Huff, this Christian apologist, I was not familiar with him. He sounds like he's from Canada, based on his accent.
He does, but we won't hold it against him.
And he, you know, he was on Joe Rogan's show and, you know, had apparently did a great job. You know, Joe Rogan is someone who's historically been very hostile to Christianity. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the origins of that, but he's mocked it in the past. He's had remarkably few Christian guests on over the years. And now he's like warming up to it. And people, so every time something like that comes up, people are like, oh, the negative world's over. Or is the negative world over? So I feel like I have to keep, just like every time I write my three worlds model, I keep thinking, I already said that. It's like the 500th time I've said this. But like, the fact is, there's still people who haven't heard it. So I have to keep talking about it coming to an end or potentially coming to an end as well. Mm. And so, and one of the things that happens, I notice, is somebody puts out a theory or they put out a strategy. And then that's what they're known for. And they just keep doubling down on it because they can't change what they're doing or can't change your mind. Because like, wow, well, I'd look dumb if this whole negative world thing wasn't real. And, I'll never forget this one time. I was consulting. I was talking to the partner of the project. There was this project that I was working on. We'd done the planning phase, and now we were going to do the implementation phase. It was going to be a multi-million-dollar project, and we're going to figure out which one the client could do, which one we can do. And I basically, as we looked at it, kind of came to the conclusion they really didn't need our help. Wow, that's bad. So I go to the client partner. I'm like, hey, I got some bad news. I'm like, the client probably isn't going to need our help. All these millions of dollars we were thinking we're not going to get. He said something that really struck with me years later. He's like, that's not bad news. We're in the job of doing the best thing for the client and not lining our own pockets. And so I stuck with me. So like, I'm in the truth business. And so I want to stick with truth regardless of, whether it's the same thing I said before or the same thing after. However, what I say is I don't think that the negative world is ending, but the cultural conditions do seem to be shifting. It seems as though the sort of woke revolution, if you will, is fading, which I think it was destined to do. You can only sustain yourself at a fever pitch too long. You know, the campus unrest of the 60s eventually came to an end. Mm-hmm. You know, periodically in America, we have these sort of social upheavals, and then they kind of come to an end. Mm-hmm. And there's what I call a consolidation phase. It kind of looks like a conservative turn, and in some respects, it is a conservative turn. But it also institutionalizes many of the changes that happened during its awakenings. Mm-hmm. So you can think about the Reagan era as representing a conservative turn in a sense. But in essence, we didn't roll back the sexual revolution or any of the changes thereof.
Right.
It was essentially institutionalized into quote unquote normal in our society. Mm-hmm. And so I think the kind of woke, call it the extreme woke phase is kind of coming to a close. Corporations are rolling back their DEI programs, et cetera, et cetera. And so I do think that suggests that the sort of overt hostility to Christianity may be, less in the present day. You saw it even in like these, I didn't watch the college national championship game between Ohio State and Notre Dame, but apparently both teams are like filled with Christians and there's a lot of discussion of Christianity. There's probably going to be some of that stuff now. Even as I said in the book, merely identifying, this is where maybe suspicious is a better word than negative. Merely identifying as a Christian does not necessarily get you in trouble. After all, Senator Raphael Warnock is a Christian minister and he never gets accused of being a Christian mm-hmm. nationalist, even though he's a pastor in the Senate, And the key is that the contents of your faith cannot materially conflict with new secular ideologies, certainly in any way that threatens that. So you could say it's not negative, but go try to ban abortion in some state and see what happens. And so I think, there is a sense in which I think there's a low tolerance. We've gone back maybe to a little more of a kind of liberal era in a sense, classically liberal era where people can think differently. At the same time, sort of social conservative culture war, not necessarily appreciated and unpopular. And I think if you look at culture, it's indisputable that we continue to move in an ever greater sort of post-Christian direction. I mean, look at Donald Trump. He won overwhelmingly popular vote on a GOP platform that removed the pro-life blank Mm-hmm. Right. And he said, I will veto any federal abortion restrictions. Mm-hmm. Now, he's done some things, you know, on the Mexico City policy and stuff like that. But this is, you know, this is a guy who is, you know, he's like, look, it's not a social conservative administration, mm-hmm. really, you know, I would say. And again, you know, you look at things like, you know, we forgot about things like gambling. Okay. Like that was a big issue in like the 90s. And, you know, these churches were opposed to gambling. We're like, they didn't even talk about gambling today. And even though it's metastasized, the idea that our president is a former casino owner, inconceivable.
Yeah.
Right. So when you contrast these things, you know, and the fact that like allegations of different, you know, sort of sexual improprieties, they literally just don't, you know, they don't, nobody cares. I mean, you know, if some Trump nominee has some accusations, they don't care. And the Democrats don't care either. They're only like talking about it because it's opportunistic. So, and, you know, again, go look at a strong red state like Ohio votes solidly in favor of abortion, solidly in favor of pot legalization. And so certainly the landscape culturally is proceeding apace into a sort of de-Christianized, de-Protestantized culture. You know, both in terms of its religious values and, you know, its social, cultural, moral values. I think in that environment, you know, maybe it's less overtly negative towards, you know, people who publicly identify as Christian in some way. At the same time, kind of the underlying de-Christianization trend, I think, continues. Now, are there some signs? Maybe of like young men like turning to the church. Yeah, there actually are some encouraging signs there. You know, some green shoots, you might say. But you know, we'll see. We'll see how that goes. I always like to say, look, the summer of love was 2 years before I was born, and I'm 55 years old. So think about how long it took to get from there to here.
Yeah.
How long is it going to take to get from here to someplace new? It's going to take a lot longer than we think. And so we need to have a long-term perspective on that. So I certainly think there's been a vibe shift in the culture. I think there's been obviously the fact that, you know, Google Maps yesterday announced that they were going to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America after Trump's order. Like that would have been inconceivable in 2017. I mean, where did the, I mean, I'm shocked. There's no resistance.
I'm surprised they did.
They're all capitulating to Trump. And so, you know, it is a new era. It is a new vibe shift. And certainly the, you know, very aggressively woke overplayed their hand on some issues. And I think there is going to be a rollback on some of the issues there. Just as, you know, in the sexual revolution, not everything that was proposed during the original kind of sexual revolution happened. You know, some things didn't stick. And, but I do think, you know, these are more animated by purely sort of populist cultural concerns. They're not really, I don't think there's anything about Trumpism that is really religious in character, evangelical in character. And again, you could go look at the issues and the upheavals. Yeah. Very similar to populist right in Europe, which are, you know, thoroughly secular phenomenons.
So you're not even just talking then about a mood. It's something more substantial than that, which is kind of one of the things I was kind of wrestling with. So I'm in the Bay Area, California, just south of San Francisco. Alex, of course, is in Pennsylvania, center of Pennsylvania, affectionately known as Pennsyltucky, to many of us. You're in Indiana. So we have very different, there's these little pockets of different cultures. And I would say that most of the time what I'm experiencing here in California is very different than like what my family back in Wisconsin or probably what you would experience, you know, in the Indianapolis area. Do you see your paradigm taking into account these vast cultural differences between the different pockets or subcultures within America?
Sure. I mean, there's a saying, the future is here, is just unevenly distributed. And so certainly there are, you know, like where I live in suburban Indianapolis, neutral to positive, I'd say in some ways, you know, being a Christian is normal. you know, or just being religious, like, of course, you know, and well, where I grew up in Southern Indiana, you know, it's still a positive world in many ways. And yet all of these, you know, ideologies are here, right? You go into our schools, you go into our libraries, and, you know, the full woke panoply has been promoted through all the institutions. And, you know, the teenagers, you know, have been thoroughly catechized by TikTok, and they're spouting the same talking points that teenagers in New York City are talking. John Tyson, who's a pastor in New York City, phenomenal pastor, church planner there, Church of the City of Manhattan. I had him on my podcast, and he made a comment that, like, the gap between New York and the rest of the country is actually narrower now than it used to be. You know, it used to be if you talk to a 50-year-old in Manhattan and like a 50-year-old in Georgia, they're going to have radically different perspectives on things, different different lives, different everything. Well, now you talk to a 17-year-old in New York, a 17-year-old in Georgia, they're watching the same influencers on TikTok. And so they're much closer. So I do think, you know, culture has disseminated out. Of course, there's regional variations. One reason I moved to the place that I moved is because I thought it would be a more congenial place to be someone such as myself, who is a public figure writing about issues that may be controversial to some, you know, that would be like a safer space, if you will, for me to be than here. And so, you know, so that's what I'd say. There's certainly a lot of regional variation in cultural conditions. And certainly if we think about missions in the context of church planning, doing ministry, you obviously have to take account of that. You know, you can't take the Tim Keller New York City playbook and deposit it into San Francisco, you know, because they're just two different cities. And so every city, although there's a lot of superficial similarities, they do have different deep economic and cultural structures and demographics and many other things. And so you have to take that into account. But I think, you know, the issues are sort of the same everywhere, you know, to some extent.
Did you know that it can take anywhere from 18 to 24 months or more for the average missionary to raise their financial support? The journey to the field is an arduous one. And for some missionaries, it goes by quicker than others. Other missionaries are waiting for the right prayer and financial partners to come alongside them and hold the rope for them as they go out to reach the lost. And so, would you consider praying for and maybe adopting an ABWE pre-field missionary, somebody that's already been commissioned and sent out from their local church, and the only thing keeping them from having a fruitful ministry on the field is simply their ability to get there? You can go to abwe.org/prefield and find a pre-field missionary, whether you just want to pray for them or whether the Lord would lead you to give to one of their ministries. Find one that you can support today at abwe.org/prefield.
So let's take it even farther, because obviously we're the missions podcast, particularly focusing on overseas missions. So how would you see, I know when we went overseas, we spent a lot of time studying the people we were going to, the country, the region we were going to, really doing a lot of analysis as best we could on the dynamics on the ground we were going to serve. Do you see this paradigm being useful for foreign missionaries, and how would they go about like using this paradigm to kind of do analysis on the place where they're going to serve?
Well, I don't know that the three worlds per se has anything to do with any other country. And in fact, one of the things I do in the book is make clear that this is about the United States. And I think there are things in other countries that, you know, indicate that they may have some similar conditions, but I don't know enough about them. And I actually proved my own point, because the one example I gave was an Australian soccer club whose president was fired for being the member of a conservative church, like a couple of days after they appointed me. And then I get all these emails from Australia going like, it's not a soccer club, it's an Australian rules football club. And so like, that'd be like me, I guess apparently it's like, would be like me, you know, saying the New York Knicks are a baseball team or something. So I've never been to Australia. I don't know anything about these countries. I do see some things that would suggest you know, that similar conditions hold there. And certainly the United States is such a culturally imperialistic power. It's like the sun. It's like the solar wind of American culture just propagates throughout the universe or the solar system. Mm. And so some places are like Mercury. They're very exposed to that. Other places are maybe more like, you know, Pluto. They're not as exposed to that. And, you know, there's lots of things in between. There's definitely some solar wind effect from the United States. But, you know, the cultural conditions in these places have to be sort of assessed on their own merits. And of course, that's why you got to have, you know, my diagnostic tools, consulting diagnostic tools may or may not be the best methodology for that, because I can take a lot of things for granted. And depending on the culture, you might need to have more use of the tools of ethnography or anthropology, sociology to better understand those places. So I don't think there's a one size fits all. And, you know, maybe in the UK, there's some similarities. Maybe not. I don't know. But thinking about how the culture is shifting, and there are some things that are a global phenomenon. Like one of the things I talk a lot about is the fertility declines, decline in marital family formation, decline in fertility. This is a global phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Rising political polarization and intrasexual conflict, intergender conflict between young men and women, global phenomenon, not necessarily in every country, but these are big international things. You know, blowbacks against migration, international phenomenon. So there are many things that do transcend borders. And that's one of the things I do try to bring to my work in the United States is every time there's something that's happening here, that's happening overseas, I try to mention the fact that it's happening overseas. So we don't sort of try to overly explain it in terms of domestic trends. You know, there are macro forces that exist at levels above the nation state or the city or the tribe or whatever you to call it. But it takes a lot of analysis to sort of dig into the particulars of what you want to look at.
One of the interesting things when you think about the current conditions, and yeah, we've got all of these different subcultures that are some are more negative than others. But overall, you kind of answered another one of my questions in advance, which is, you know, what is the effect that, you know, TikTok and some of these other dominating forces, you know, you liken it to solar wind, right? Have what is their effect on steering the culture overall? Because, you know, these cultural changes are slow rolling. And missiologists in particular, we're accustomed to thinking of movements as broadly percolating from the bottom of society up almost organically. You know, we think about, okay, well, 2% evangelicals, that's enough to gradually saturate the rest of a population and reach them with the gospel, right? So we think of these things in very organic categories. But then there's also forces like TikTok or forces like the Trump administration, where you have a very relatively small number of people holding the microphone. They have the largest platform, and somehow they're able to steer that rudder of culturally acceptable opinion much more quickly. Maybe that doesn't really shift from a positive world to a neutral to a negative on its own. Maybe that really can only affect some of these incidental mood shifts. You've kind of spoken a little bit to that. And my question is, what do you see as being the marching orders then that we have in light of the current moment, assuming, yeah, the culture overall is still increasing in its negativity towards the overall framework of the Christian faith? What strategies do you see as being right and proper and prudent and biblical to employ in a negative world over and against a neutral world?
Sure. And I'll try to keep this brief because I know we're going to be coming up on time here before long. What I'd say is, again, you hit it at the beginning. Act more like a minority rather than a majority, which means I think, you know, I would submit we should be much more worried about what we're doing and less concerned about what other people are doing. You know, and you know, we have a lot of business to take care of internally. There's way too many scandals in the church. You know, way too many people whose lives are conformed to the world. You know, many families who are not where they need to be in terms of the internals. And so I think fundamentally, you know, we need to focus on, take the log out of our own eyes, it's like in Ephesians where Paul says, stop stealing, start working. Then you have something to give to someone else. I think that's the pattern. Let's stop doing bad things. Let's take care of our own business. And then we have something to give other people. Mm. And that doesn't mean we avoid, external engagement. And again, I'm putting evangelization to the side as being in a separate category. Of course, we're always going to continue doing that kind of missions. But I would say, we need to be turning the dial to be more focused. And one of the things we get from a negative world is we don't have to have a least common denominator Christianity anymore. And we can raise the bar on what it means to be a Christian, because I think the Bible sets a pretty high bar for what's expected.
No, that's helpful. And we do need to tend to our own house first. I think everything that you're describing as far as doing that, as far as getting our own house in order, is necessary in order to support outreach and mission later on. It's not that that's not good, but we have to get first things first. Right. And now's a good time to take a look in the mirror and make sure that we're the type of people that the Lord could bless with evangelistic and missional fruit. And we need to position ourselves well for that. Aaron, thanks for joining us, and remind us how people can hear more from you.
Go to aaronwren.com, sign up. That's all you got to do. And check it out and let me know what you think.
Excellent. We appreciate you coming back on. In our overtime episode, we are going to discuss now this whole question of the mood shift in the context of the church and its mood with respect to missions. Scott and I are going to throw that around. Is the American church increasing in favorability towards missions internationally, or is it decreasing in favorability towards missions? You don't want to miss that conversation happening at missionspodcast.com/premium. That is where you can get all of our bonus episodes, as well as other exclusive content like our recent webinar with Chad Vegas, where he challenged me for some things that I had said on the show. That was a fun conversation, as well as some others that we've hosted. And you can get access to our private discussion thread and a free gift. So you want to sign up for that at $9.99 per month as a ministry partner of the show. Speaking of ministry partners, another thank you, again, a warm thank you to Reformation Heritage Books for partnering with us, and a reminder to go and check them out at heritagebooks.org. And of course, the Missions Podcast is a ministry of ABWE, a global family of ministries reaching into nearly 90 nations for 98 years now. We're coming up on that centennial anniversary. And if you want to learn more about how you or your church can take your next steps in the Great Commission, go to abwe.org. And to get more content from this show, head on over to missionspodcast.com. You'll be glad you did. Until our next conversation on missions, theology, and practice, go make disciples of all the nations. And we'll see you in our next episode.